Hello, and welcome to this episode of Midlife Men. Today, I'm joined by Paul Baylis. I'll leave Paul to introduce himself. But what we're going to talk about today, what we're going to explore is depression, particularly depression in the workplace. Paul's going to talk a bit about his own experiences, and then we'll talk about some more general advice and techniques. So, Paul, welcome. Perhaps you want to provide some background to you and your career.
Oh, thank you very much, Philip. You know, the first thing I must say, I don't present myself as being an expert in the field of stress, anxiety, or depression. The aim of having this conversation with you, it's really to share some of my own personal experience and observations. So a little bit about me. I'm nearly 60 years old, believe it or not. I originally grew up in London in the UK, in a town called Brixton. And if I could look back at, you know, the five-year-old me at that time on the streets of Brixton, there is absolutely no way I would think my life will turn out the way it has. And, you know, I've been very fortunate. I've had to deal with some challenges in life, personally and professionally. But I've been very fortunate to have a really good career. I've traveled the world. I've worked with some amazing people. And, you know, I now have my own management consultancy business where I work as a contractor. So, you know, in all sense of the external measures, I would say I've been successful. However, I will also say that success is not an antidepressant. Being successful doesn't mean that you're immune from the challenges that affect you as an individual. And that's perhaps some of the things that it would be great to explore in our conversation here.
Brilliant. Okay. So looking back on your career then, and particularly at, you know, some of the places you've worked in, what was the, you know, what was the culture like, specifically at the organization you were working for that contributed to your experience of depression? You know, what sort of specific pressures, you know, did you face in your job?
Yeah, it's interesting because I thought a lot about it. And, you know, one of the things is obviously I'm not going to name the organization because it's not about the organization, it's about what happened within it. But I came across a really interesting statistic, which was influenced by a gentleman called Michael Marmot. And he came up with this assessment that only 13% or approximately 13% of people actually enjoyed their work. You go into work and you really loved it. He said that 63% of people sleepwalk through their work. They're apathetic. You turn up, you do your job, and you do it because it pays the bills, it pays the mortgage and whatever else you need. And 24% actually didn't like their job at all. And when we look at that, that's 87% of people who actually not really loving their work. And I found that I got myself into a situation where I was initially in the military. And then when I left the military, I went into professional publishing. I worked for a really major publisher. And that afforded me the opportunity to do a lot of traveling. And then I had a young family and I decided to stop the traveling and had a career which was more based locally within the UK. And as I went along, I worked in different sectors. So I've worked in publishing, I've worked in data, I've worked in financial services. That was so not compatible with my personality. Too aggressive, too cold. It wasn't about the clients, it's always about the institution I worked with. And I couldn't relate to that. And that was not a depressive place to be, but it was something I very quickly identified. This just wasn't conducive with my personality. So professionally and personally, I couldn't relate to it. So I left that. And then I went and worked in the public sector. And the public sector, for anyone who's not UK-based and hears this podcast, is basically a government-type organization. And I thought, yippee, here we go. You know, for me, it was, you know, I can now slow down. You know, public sector compared to the private sector, less pressure. It would be easier. I could turn up, do a 9 to 5. I was in for a terrible surprise. You know, we went from being very much a directional type organization, which you had profit as the focal point of success, to being very much a collaborative type organization where service design and service delivery and output was your measure of success. And I got very much involved in what I do now, which is change and transformation. And the biggest area of issue where I start to really feel the impact of being in a place which wasn't supportive of you as an individual was doing some major transformation work. And it was over a period of about 3 or 4 years. And we were transforming everything. You know, we had a turnover of about 1.2 billion and there were huge austerity measures in place. And in a 4-year period, we had to take out 250 million out of that organization. And the impact of that was basically changing the way people work. It was cutting a lot of jobs. It was introducing automation. It was reviewing processes. It was large scale disruption. And when you start to be involved in that type of environment, initially it's challenging, but it's not difficult. So it's mentally challenging. But as time went on, the stress of doing that work started to play itself out into something which was a lot more impactful.
So when did you first notice these sorts of symptoms arising, and how did they manifest themselves and you know, progress?
So, I mean, I first started to notice them was I could pride myself in my early part of my career of being, I mean, phenomenally sharp. And I think that's partially due to being younger as well. But I could walk into a meeting. No, I didn't need to bring a notepad or pen or anything. I could literally sit in a meeting for an hour with multiple people there, listen to the meeting, engage, walk out, and a day or two later still tell you exactly what each individual said. You know, I was able to really take on lots of information and analyze it and manage it, you know, without actually even having to take notes. It's just the way I used to be. I started to notice the impact, and it was one day I was in a meeting, and this is probably a good few years into doing this particular type of work, this program. And I went in with a notepad and I sat in the meeting and I'm furiously taking notes. So something had changed that gradually I'd gone from this person who didn't need to take notes to now I was taking notes. I wasn't consciously aware of it, but I was furiously taking notes. And then I came out of the meeting. I looked at my notepad and I had no clue about what had just happened in that meeting. And I looked at my notepad and I was trying to recall what my action points were, what other people had done, and I had no clue. And I thought to myself, oh my days, there is something seriously wrong here. What is happening? And that became the start of me becoming consciously aware something was happening with my ability to function wholly competently in the work environment. I will say this, because it's key part of what I do now, but I will say this. Organizations, they really have got to take control and ownership of the culture that they have, because it is that culture that contributes to mental health issues. When I look back, I realize that the way that we were all working was just unreasonable. And we're talking at the height of it, I would go 3 days, possibly 4 days working through the day, coming home, having a short break, and then working on some form of documentation, working through the night, grabbing a small amount of sleep, getting up, going back into work, doing the same thing again. Coming home, short break, working through the night. And this was a constant pattern. And it doesn't mean that there aren't times in different types of career where the requirement for your role, I'm not saying that we should work like that, but there are some roles where the urgency and importance of what you're doing may demand pushing yourself to that level. However, that should not be a consistent thing. Absolutely no way. And in this particular organization, it became the norm.
Did you feel it was expected of you? You know, was everyone else doing it?
Without a doubt, it was phenomenally toxic. You know, I was part of an internal consultancy team. There was about six of us there. In the 4 years, we had 9 different heads leading that team. You know, and we're talking, you know, a head role, which was significantly senior in this organization. And people come in with their enthusiasm. Oh, I know how to do this. And they'll come in and then they will see the toxicity of the organization. You know, I recall seeing directors shouting and swearing at people publicly in the office. That type of behavior should never be allowed. You know, we're talking about producing. So a lot of the work I was doing is around about technical transformation. So bringing in, using technology to transform how we deliver work. So it's looking at technology solutions, making changes. And obviously, with my background, what I would do is put business cases together, then develop program and project plans of how you're going to do that. And we're talking multi-million pound type activities. And we're also talking about, you know, taking out a third of the employees. We had, excluding our school staff, there were about 9,000 employees. And when we finished the whole program, we were down to about 6. So you're talking about taking a third of a workforce out, you know. So they were things and decisions that you didn't take lightly. You know, you had to be really considered that if I'm making a projection or I'm implementing something that is going to remove somebody's job, I do that with every single effort to make sure the decision is the best decision for the organization and the person. So you produce very detailed technical documents, and they will be, you know, 50, 100, 200 pages, depending on what it was. And I still laugh now, because the reason why I'm laughing is because I've just recently finished a role with an organization, and I can't believe the culture's still there. And you produce these technical documents, big impactful decisions. You've got your summary document there, and the director will look at it, look at all the pages and say, can you get that onto 3 pages of a slide, please? And you'd look at them and say, you know what, even if you just read the summary and take the direction of the summary and not even go through the full document, you're about to make a decision that's going to cost your organization a huge amount of money and change the lives of a huge amount of your staff. And you want it on 2 slides. And that type of behavior and that type of apathy amongst those leaders and the opinion makers created a very, very uncomfortable environment within the organization. And again, I recall, you know, I became very much aware once I became unwell I'd go into afterwards, I'd become sensitive to picking it up in others. And, you know, as much as we're talking about stress, anxiety, and depression, and it's seen as a negative, it's also a positive, because it's almost like I've got a anti-depression radar. I can pick this up. And I would have these conversations, and I would see the most stoic individuals and their public faces privately, they would be bursting into tears. Once I asked the question, how are you? And they'd say, I'm fine. And I said, no, how are you really? And I'd pause and they'd look at me and they would know I've noticed them, and their face would go very still. And then you would see the change in body. You know, generally people will start to curl up, face will start to drop, and you could see like the stress and the press. And I can't believe some of the people who I thought were like really hard stone face, and they would burst into tears. And these, I'm talking about men here as well as women. And you realize that the toxicity of that organization, you know, the exec team knew it. They knew it. That either they were not capable to deal with it, or they chose not to. But quite often, a lot of the issues around this type of impact are things that you can address. They're external. They really are external things. And with the willingness, you can actually do something about it. So I first noticed that when I started to see that my ability to function was impaired.
And were there other symptoms as well that you started to witness?
Oh, without a doubt, my sleep was terrible. You know, really had some major challenges with my sleeping. I started to become less sociable. I'm a very sociable person. And I just didn't have the energy to really go out and hang out with friends and do the things that I normally enjoyed. You know, I think I probably at some point in time became quite short. You know, after a while, it's just like, you know, want everything to be done quickly. You know, I'm quite a passive person, although I'm described as quite an alpha character, but a very gentle person. I don't know how that works out, but my temperament became very impatient. And I found that I was constantly reactive, not just professionally, but it started to impact personally as well. So the enjoyment of life became less. The wanting to engage socially became less. And yeah, physically and mentally, I started to really, really feel it, until at some point I thought, right, okay, let me reach out.
So that was your worst. I mean, what was the worst point then regarding your symptoms? You know, what was going through your mind?
So the worst point for me was I was absolutely exhausted. And out of the team of six of us, there was one lady and five guys. And I'm looking back now, and all five of the men ended up being very seriously ill. One person, and I can't say it's due to the work, but I think it was a big factor, had a heart attack and died. Another one ended up with some thyroid or glandular type issue, quite serious. Another one had hair falling out. And we're all healthy, really healthy, fit people when we started. But we all started to develop different ailments. And I remember going to the HR director, and I said to her, I said, look, I don't know if you're realizing, but the team is struggling. We're under so much pressure. And she said to me, yes, the exec board has noticed we're going to bring some help in. We've realized we've done all this work. And again, I've got to caveat it with what I said right at the beginning. Being successful is not an antidepressant. Being successful can mask the fact that you're putting yourself under a huge amount of pressure. And she said, they've noticed all the work we've done, how well we've functioned, how much we've brought to the organization. But they've also noticed that, you know, we're seriously affected. And she said, right, we'll bring in some help. And I said, oh, that's absolutely great. Anyway, I had some leave, and I remember this. It's probably around about this sort of time of the year, because it was leading up to my birthday. And I decided to take some annual leave. And I took the time off, and I went to bed. And I didn't get out of bed for maybe 2 or 3 days. I mean, I just literally went to bed, had annual leave. And I was like, and at the point I could get out of bed, I thought, what the heck is going on here?
So you think that was a pure physiological reaction to the stress that you've been under at work?
Yeah. I think there's a point with depression where your body will say to you, enough is enough. You are no longer in control of this. And your body will say, we're not doing this. And I thought my body said to me, we're not doing this. So I got myself off to my doctor, to my GP, and I went along, still not accepting that I was impacted by depression. Not at all. Because I'm a professional person. I've got this wonderful career behind me with all this stuff I've done. I have a reputation. I have a profile. I have a personality. Another factor as well is that I think sometimes we don't realize how much we define ourselves by our work. You know, we may define ourselves in our relationships. So being a husband, a father, or family relations, being a brother or a son or whatever. But if those things aren't working very well, and for me at that time, I was single, those things weren't working well for me. Work then became the defining factor, or how I validated my worth, my self-worth. So for me, if that suddenly stopped working, then I'm suddenly, where do I start to validate who I am? And that external validation came from work. I went to see my GP, and I sat in front of him. I recall the meeting, and I sat in front of him, and he knew me very well. He knew me very well. And I said, look, you know, I'm really tired. You know, I just think I've overworked a little bit. And could you just sign me off for maybe a week so I can get some extra rest? And he looked at me and he said, you're not tired. He said, I know you. You're depressed. And I looked at him in horror. And it was like a Band-Aid been ripped off, or it was like sitting naked in front of the GP. It was like being exposed. And I remember stammering, trying to cover up my vulnerability and say, no, I'm not depressed. You know, I'm just tired. You know, we've got these projects. I'm working really hard. And I did everything I could to try and cover what the doctor clearly saw. And he said, no, you're definitely depressed. You've been working like this for such a long time. And, you know, this is way too much. And your body's telling you, time to stop. You need to be off for a minimum of 3 months. I said, no, we can't do this. It's not possible. I mean, and in my head, my doctor then became the person who's coming to assassinate my career. You know, it's like his words was a gun. He's holding to my head, and he's now about to destroy my career. How can you say I'm depressed and give me that label? And 3 months? Are you crazy? What are people going to say? Anyway, we ended the conversation, and I said, look, I just need a sick note for a couple of weeks. All right, so I agreed to a couple of weeks, and, you know, just say, you know, undue stress. He wrote out his sick note and he gave it to me, and I left. And I went and sat in my car and feeling really tired. And I just thought, that was difficult. I looked down on the sick note. And he had I'm feeling quite teary right now thinking about this. And he wrote down, suffering with depression, should not come back to work for 12 weeks.
So seeing it written down really validated, did it, confirmed it?
I can feel it now.
Yeah.
And I sat in that car. You could probably hear it in my voice. I sat in that car and I cried. I literally sat in the car and I cried.
Was that relief, do you think? Were you relieved or exposed? What do you think drove that?
Massive mixture. It was a massive mixture because it was both. It's now out there because I knew I couldn't go back to work in the state I was. But I had to give somebody the sick note to tell them why I was off. And the sick note actually said what it was. So there was the end of my career, the end of my life as I know it. I'll never be the same again. I'm useless. And I don't know how long I sat in that car, but it was, I can assure you, it was a long time. I couldn't drive. I just sat there. And I eventually drove home and I went to my bed and I didn't get out of my bed again, probably for a week or so. And I'm still on leave. So there was the peace of not having to tell work what I've just been told. But then there came a point where, and I remember having good people around you is really important. It's really, really important. And I told two of my closest friends and they came and they were very supportive. But it came from where I had to tell work. And I remember making a call to my then manager, who at that time must have been the fifth person into the role. And it's laughable now, you know, because that should have been an indicator to the organization that what they were asking this team to do was too much. And I said to him, I've been signed off with, and eventually I said depression. And he said to me, okay, you know, you need to look after yourself and words to that effect, soothe, the type of managerial talk you expect, you know, from a manager who's just been told by the employee that reports into him that he's been signed off for depression. And it was no surprise to him, no doubt, because he could see with the team what was happening. He could see. And I think one of the things I learned from that is that when you are in it, you don't see what other people see. We leak. We leak a lot as people. When we're going through things, and I know this because I've done all sorts of stuff in terms of body language, especially when I was in business development, and they teach you about this, that, you know, the things that you give away. And so I realized that other people probably noticed my performance had dropped well before I did, you know, and this manager, he just said to me, he said, look, take some time out for yourself. Would you like me to put you in touch with somebody who has gone through what you're going through now? And I just said, yes, please. That's all I could think of. Yes, please. Anyway, he said, let me go and have a word and see what I can do. And then that ended that call. And at that point, the phone went down and I probably just thought, my life is over now. My professional career is dead. And wow, this is what you get for trying too hard. And I come back to that phrase, you know, being successful doesn't mean you're immune from the impact, sometimes a negative impact of your success.
So how long did it take you? Was it that week after you'd been to the doctor where you were almost, you know, out of denial, but actually accepting that what the doctor said was correct. Did it take that time? And when you spoke to your, you know, your director, had you processed it by then? Were you thinking, right, this is a diagnosis, I acknowledge it, I'm going to deal with it?
I was still in phenomenal denial. the denial was, you know, a bit like Star Wars, where they say the force is strong within you. The denial was strong within me, without a doubt. Although I had told him, the then act of sending in the sickness certificate probably took about another 6 weeks. I remembered it took ages. Because it was, you know, it's just like a series of confirmations that you are broken. You know, and that brokenness, you know, I use the analogy of, you know, I was one of these people in my, you know, in my, probably about 10 years ago, I think it was, or thereabouts. I was out playing football. I was playing football and, you know, doing the usual thing, drive late. It was cold. It was winter. And I decided that I didn't need to warm up, you know. So I just got out there in the cold, you know, kind of jogged for about 30 seconds and then started to play football on this five-a-side. And this was at Wimbledon Crystal Palace. This was at Crystal Palace's football grounds. And then I did a turn. And I heard a massive, in my head, it was a really loud sort of bang. And then suddenly, about 2 or 3 seconds later, I felt this awful pain and I hit the ground. I'd snapped my Achilles tendon, literally just snapped it, and went straight to hospital. And they looked and said, yeah, good thing you came straight in. Yeah, you totally snapped your Achilles. We're going to have to sort this out. And then I had this massive oversized boot and they did all the treatment to repair it. And then I had to wear this boot, which I ended up wearing probably, I think it's about 6 months, maybe a bit longer because it took a while to heal. And here's the difference. Wearing that boot and having snapped my Achilles tendon, both professionally and personally, you know, I got so much sympathy. Oh my God, poor you, you snapped your foot. I'd get on public transport, people get up and give me a seat. I get on the tube. You're right, mate. You know, you want a seat? You know, anything I was doing, because I had this boot and the crutches, people were really sympathetic. They were really understanding. I had broken my Achilles. They could see it. They could relate to it. But it's strange because stress, anxiety, depression is way more widely impactful in society than snapped Achilles. Yet we get very scared very quickly when we say we've broken or impaired our cognitive ability. We've impaired our ability to interact. We've put our minds under so much stress that our minds have said enough. We need time to stop, to heal, a bit like the boot I had to put on, and to repair. And we get, I think, a society, we're a lot better now, but I think we're still quite cautious about discussing this. And this is probably why I wanted to talk about it a bit more, especially as men. You know, as men, you know, it's crazy that we have to be so cajoled to go and see a doctor when there are issues affecting us, you know. And I'm hoping that this conversation we're having will encourage other men to just have a conversation, even if it's with one person. Go on, you know, your life will not be over.
That is the important message, isn't it? That is. So how did you, what did you do next? What did you do next in terms of trying to find ways of repairing yourself, you know, finding support?
So the thing I would say is you can't really overcome any mental health or mental well-being issues alone. I think it's incredibly difficult. You do need supportive friends. You may need some professional help, and accept it. Accept that you're not going to do this on your own. So the manager put me in touch with a colleague, and he doesn't mind me saying his name. And his name is John. The name is Jess, but his name's John Dixon. Put it out there for the public to know. John Dixon. Love that guy. When my manager said to me that, oh, do you know that Jess suffers from depression? I said to him, Jess who? I mean, there's only one Jess. Jess who? He goes, Jess, John Dixon. Nah, no chance. John was one of the most talented, or is, because he's still here. John is a talented technical program and project management professional. In the team of people that we worked with, he's one of the individuals that I would look up to in terms of just how quick and able he was at dealing with issues, dealing with people, coming up with answers, coming up with solutions. How the hell can he be depressed? There's absolutely no way. So he put me in touch with him, and John gave me a call. And he said, you know, really sorry that you're going through this, you know. And the other manager was called John. He said, John told me what's happened, and I'm here to see what I can do to help. And just to let you know, you're in great company. And then he reeled off a list of people, current and historical people, who suffered with depression. And I was like, oh, my God. And I mean, and we know the names now. I mean, but it was at that time, what he did was he normalized the fact that, look, you're not that special. this is not a Paul issue, you know. You're not the only one. This is quite normal, especially amongst high-performing individuals. You know, and he sent me a book. I remember he sent me a book, and it was almost like a kid's book, really simple language. And it just told the stories of all these famous people who had suffered and lived with depression. And he shared his story. And his story was basically, he had hit an impact, probably not dissimilar to myself, where he became depressed. And now he lives as a high-functioning depressive. I probably got that wrong, but it's basically, he knows that he's susceptible to future depression. So whenever he feels that things are too stressful or too difficult, he pulls himself away a little bit, you know, and he manages that. He has a little bit of downtime and he comes back. Now, I never knew this at all, and I'd worked with this guy for a good while. So getting the professional help was speaking to John, having somebody to talk to and normalize it, speaking to some friends and family. I had a friend, his name's Jason. He's passed, you know, unfortunately he died a few years ago. And Jason, absolutely loved this guy to bits. Every day he sent me a text. Hi P, how you doing? Just to let you know that I'm here if you ever need to call me. And it would go weeks before I had the ability to respond to him. I couldn't respond. But yet every day, this text would appear. And he would get no response. And eventually, when I was able to respond, I'd respond, say, thank you, really appreciate you sending the text. It means a lot to me. Because it was a few people like that that just kept me aware. And I sat down with him one day and I said, you know, I wasn't responding to you. And he said, I know you couldn't, but I needed you to know I was there. So, you know, all this conversations about dealing with depression, sometimes for those of us who are supporting people who are going through issues, sometimes you don't get a response, but that doesn't mean what you're doing isn't impactful. And sometimes it does take your experience to enable you to have enough empathy and understanding to help somebody else along their journey. And, you know, as a result of this experience, I've had so many family friends who have come to me and said, oh, by the way, I'm going through X, or my sister or my brother's going through X, or, and then I've been able to talk, would you talk to them? And I would go and talk to them. And then they found it easier to open up to me because they'll look at me and say, you suffered with depression? Oh, hell no. And I'll say, yeah, I did. And, you know, this is what the journey was, and this is where I'm at, and this is what I'm doing now. And I'm absolutely fine. And, you know, I've, you know, this is 10, 12, maybe 15 years ago, you know, and this is what I do. I now engage in physical well-being. I try to maintain it. Sometimes I lose. You know, I try to engage in music and art. I try to engage in things that keeps the poor personal side awake and alive and vibrant, so it balances off with the stress of doing any work. So, you know, my life isn't validated by my work experience. My life is about who I am as a person. And work then supplements that.
Thanks for joining me for part one of this episode, where I've been talking to Paul Baylis about depression, particularly depression in the workplace. Join us in part two, which will be available shortly, where Paul talks in more detail about his experience and also about the importance of creating your own persona outside of just work. If you have a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to cover in the podcast, or if you have a story you'd like to share, then please contact me either on Twitter at MidlifeMen or email me at midlifemen01@gmail.com. Join me next time when we talk to other midlife men about their stories, and maybe you'll find that they resonate with you. Thank you.